Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Friday, December 28th, 2018. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live to tape steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, it's the best of 2018. As we begin to wind down the year, what do we have for you today? Actually, we have one of this interview in the moment.
Mesmerized you.
It mesmerized me, but it had everybody in the office talking too,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Wait, what?
I think you were especially. Well, maybe not.
Jeez, Matt.
I just say this was obviously one of Sam's favorite interviews.
Man. All right. You seemed pretty excited about it at the time. I guess maybe not so much anymore.
No, I was excited about it.
You've really gotten an attitude since vacation started. Jesus. Well, maybe Matt was a little tepid on this one. Were you? This is interesting.
No, yeah, I totally. I'm all about the 19th century stuff.
Oh, my God.
And how it pertains
Talk
to Jordan Peterson.
Backhanded. Yeah, well, it's also pretty relevant in terms of Donald Trump, and it's pretty relevant in terms of the American public.
Okay.
Matt. That's all. Like, it doesn't have fascism in it. I can't like it.
That's not accurate. You're being too sensitive.
All right. This is a great interview, I think. Fascinating. A little bit different for us, but... very telling in terms of the moment we're living in. It is Professor Emily Odgen writing the book Credulity, A Cultural History of U.S. Mesmerism. Turns out mesmerism was named after the guy Mesmer, who was a snake oil salesman, essentially. And the dynamic between the snake oil salesman and the public, that's what we're looking at here. It's a fascinating story. People are going to really enjoy it. And then, of course, we got Matt's picks afterwards, which will probably all be about fascism and nothing else.
Yep.
Funny fascist stuff. So stick around for that. It is we're doing a freebie Friday today because it's a vacation. And, of course, you want to become a member. Please do so. Go to jointhemajorityreport.com. Support this show. Get the shows ad-free and get some bonuses every now and then. Plus, every day you get an extra hour plus of content. Today we're giving it to you for free, give you a little taste, because it's the end of 2018. It's a way for us to say thank you for your listenership. First, I got to tell you that 2018 has been a difficult year for human rights. Have you ever wondered how rights abuses are documented around the world? You probably have. With the sheer volume of global crises we're seeing, from civilian casualties in Syria to ethnic cleansing in Myanmar to the caging of children on U.S. borders, it's critical that we expose the truth in order to defend the rights of all and bring those responsible to justice. Human Rights Watch does just that. They're an independent, nonprofit organization known for their accurate fact-finding, impartial reporting, and targeted advocacy, often in partnership with local activists and human rights groups. They accept no money from any government but rely on the support of informed, dedicated people just like you. So if human rights are important to you, visit hrw.org/majority. Make a donation and support its vital work around the world. When you do, not only is your gift tax deductible, it will be matched dollar for dollar until 2019. That means your donation will go twice as far to advance justice and defend the basic dignity of people who need it most. Again, that's hrw.org/majority. One of today's sponsors is Skillshare. Right now, as I'm on vacation, I guarantee you, I have now probably watched 3 to 4 like different, essentially classes. I can't vouch for what I've watched, but I'm pretty sure I've done the accounting at this point. I have not done the meditation. Refuse. And I bet I've noodled around a little bit. It's going to do that Google Analytics, but more accounting, I think, and Photoshop was the other one I wanted to do. And hopefully I've done that by now. And the first 500 people who go to skl.sh/majority are going to get 2 whole months of totally free access to Skillshare's entire library of super quality online courses and tutorials. Skillshare is a vibrant online learning community that offers courses on everything from design to video editing, photography, business, technology, cooking, meditation, and everything in between. There are Skillshare courses for everyone. You'll have no problem finding courses that's going to be useful to you both in your personal and your professional life. You want to sharpen your skills with something you already love doing? You want to learn how to do something totally new? Skillshare, it's got you covered. They got courses for entrepreneurs, courses on computer coding, web development, personal nutrition, learning new languages. That's what I want to do. Spanish, I keep saying that, but now is the time, I think. Photoshop, you name it. You can get 2 entire months of free access to every single course offered by Skillshare by just going to skl.sh/majority. That's 2 free months. Think of all the things you can do and learn in 2 months. Again, that's skl.sh/majority. I put a link underneath this video. If you're watching on YouTube, if you're listening, I put it into the podcast description. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Credulity, A Cultural History of U.S. Mesmerism with Emily Ogden. On the phone, it's a pleasure to welcome Emily Ogden. She is an associate professor of English at the University of Virginia and author of Credulity, A Cultural History of U.S. Mesmerism. Emily, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much, Sam. It's great to be here.
I have to tell you, I've gone through 5 decades now, believing that the word mesmerism meant something. I didn't realize it came from a person.
Yeah. It comes from Franz Anton Mesmer, who invented a science that he called animal magnetism. And he thought that he could direct an invisible fluid into people's bodies and heal them. But people who didn't think he could do that started to make fun of him and call it mesmerism instead after his name. And that's the name that stuck.
So what is mesmerism? I mean, as defined as a sort of, I guess, a meta description of what Franz Mesmer was doing.
So the fastest way for us to get at it today is to say that it was hypnotism, except that it started before hypnotism and it's the ancestor of hypnotism. But when we go to see a stage hypnotist today, or if we even go to see a therapeutic hypnotist today, like somebody who would help us stop smoking, they're practicing something very similar to what mesmerists practiced in the 18th and 19th century. So what they would do is they would make various gestures, sometimes stare straight into people's eyes in a way that we might call mesmerizing in our sense of the word. And then people would go into these trance-like states where the effects really varied. Maybe they would do foolish things like people do when they're hypnotized on stage. Now, maybe they would find that their sort of mysterious illnesses started to feel better. Some of them even said that they could become clairvoyant. And so it was a range of different activities, but all of them had to do with the idea that this bond with the mesmerist, maybe mediated by a strange fluid, gave you unusual abilities and sometimes gave the mesmerist control over you.
I had thought, I mean, I guess if you had asked me a couple of weeks ago, I would have assumed that this was part of a tradition that was thousands of years old in some fashion, like that it had something to do with witch doctors or shamans or something to that effect. Is it there was a certain amount of show involved in this that made it different, or was it that dynamic of just like one person being able to sort of impact another person as opposed to one person just doing it because they've taken, I don't know, some type of hallucinogen or something
yeah.
like that?
Well, it's a really good question because it actually is a question people have been asking since the very beginning when Franz Anton Mesmer showed up and started shooting animal magnetism into people's bodies. The people who wanted to debunk him said, this is just shamanism, and it's what's been done by quote-unquote primitive people for since time immemorial, according to these debunkers. And then mesmerists themselves would say, well, we actually, we're not just recycling the practices of shamans and, as you said, witch doctors. We are subjecting those to a new rational approach. So we're doing what those priests thought they were doing through magic, we're actually doing through science. So it is, according to both sides, both the debunkers and the practitioners, like magical practices, but in one case, you know, the debunkers think it's like them in that it's a fraudulent version of them, and then the practitioners say it's like them in that it's a scientific version of them, sort of like we would say chemistry is a scientific version of alchemy.
That dynamic, I think, is the one that I find really fascinating, the relationship between the practitioners and the debunkers. And it almost is like it gets to the point where it's like a snake eating its own tail at one point. It sort of feels
that's
like.
That's right.
And we'll get there. I want to, because this has, you wrote an opinion piece about Donald Trump in the New York Times that I'd like to sort of land on in a bit, mm-hmm. because that is, there's a lot of incredible insight, I think, to understand this dynamic and how, from a political sense, we can capitalize on it, which is in some ways also reminiscent of the book and the story of mm-hmm, the mesmerist mm-hmm, in a way. Mm-hmm. So let's,
yeah.
I mean, so tell us a dynamic of that. Like there's Dodds and Grimes, I think, and there's also Stone and Brackett. Like just, you can choose whichever dynamic, you know, whichever, couple you want. Give us an example of that dynamic as, you know, we go past the Benjamin Franklin debunking Mesmer.
Yeah, it's exactly as you say. The really interesting thing about mesmerism is that you sometimes find that the practitioner and the debunker are saying almost exactly the same thing, that mesmerism is an art of deception. But for one, that makes it a fraud, and for the other, that makes it a legitimate science. So let me talk about the people that I talked about in my New York Times piece, which is titled Donald Trump Mesmerist. And those are, as you said, J. Stanley Grimes and John Bovey Dodds. And from a certain perspective, these guys both end up being mesmerists, but Grimes starts out as a debunker. So what Grimes did was that he watched this other mesmerist, a third guy, whose name was J.R. Buchanan, mesmerizing people. And Grimes said to himself, the physical theories underlying this practice are complete bunk. What Buchanan claimed he was doing was that he was touching different parts of the skull of the subject, and as a result, he would elicit these different performances of personality. So he would get a big, tough guy to pretend to nurse and fondle a child by touching a certain part of his brain, and he would get a woman who was known to be timid to be quite strident by touching another part of her brain. And of course, there are sort of gender stereotypes that he was playing with here. And what Grimes said was, this has nothing to do with touching parts of the brain. He's indicating to the subjects what he wants from them, and he's getting it. And that's what we would call hypnotic suggestion. So this is a real phenomenon that you can get people to kind of fall into line with what you're saying by telling them a certain story about it. But Grimes didn't stop at debunking. He started actually doing these things on stage too, but he was sort of trying to show that Buchanan had the theory right, wrong, but then he started to develop his own theory.
All right, now, let me just add
yeah,
here.
Sure.
We're talking about the 1850s here now.
Yeah,
just so
good
that
point.
We can,
yeah. It's important to say this is not going on now, although it almost seems like it could be. But yes,
yes.
1850s.
And
1840s, 1850s.
I want to just make explicit the difference here. While Buchanan is basically saying there is a completely physical, a biological explanation for what's happening with the behavior of these people. I'm pressing a certain part of the brain and I'm triggering it, and it's a physiological response on some level. Whereas Grimes is debunking it by saying, no, this is just simply a psychological almost trick, if you will.
Well, it would be nice if it were that simple, but it wasn't quite, because Grimes actually thought there was a physiological response too, but he thought it was much simpler and didn't have to do with certain areas of the brain. He thought it had to do with just one area of the brain. And so the whole scientific cachet of Buchanan's idea would have just dissolved at a touch if Grimes was right, because the whole point for Buchanan was that he could localize parts of the brain almost like we would do with an fMRI now through mesmerism. And Grimes was saying, no, you can't do that. But then the third person who came along, John Bowlby Dodds, just sort of dropped the whole question of whether this was true or whether this was false, the fact that Grimes was a debunker, and he took Grimes' new version of the practice, put a new physical fluid back in, and just ran with it as a new form of mesmerism. And Grimes spent a good part of the rest of his life trying to get people to quit listening to Dodds and realize that Dodds had plagiarized and at the same time reversed him and taken his debunking out, and no one really seemed to care. So on these different sides, the positions that they were actually articulating or saying out loud were so similar that a mesmerist could plagiarize a debunker, and yet on some level they were meant to be opposites. You know, one was a skeptic and the other wasn't. And so that's the dynamics that most interest me in the book. How do we get this practice that looks exactly the same, whether you're debunking it or you're doing it?
And I mean, let's talk about it from the perspective of the audience. Like, and maybe before we get that, we mm-hmm. should maybe also talk about Charles Poyen, who I guess found a different application for this stuff, right? Like, I mean, is there a different, like, when we see this, let's talk about the applications in the relationship with the audience, I guess, because in some instances, yeah. it seems to be like I'm putting on a show or you know, or an exhibit, I guess, of, you know, yeah. a biological discovery. And then in other areas, it's used in sort of like very practical application, supposedly.
That's right. Yeah, good point. So the first application was medical cure, sort of like people thought that they could cure diseases at this time, possibly by applying electricity to people's bodies. They thought they could use mesmerism to cure people. And Poyen, who's the founder of mesmerism and was active, founder of mesmerism in the U.S., I should say, and was active about 15 to 20 years before Grimes and Dodds and Buchanan. He did cures. He did do some lecturing to large audiences, but nothing like the big theatrical displays that you would see later. And the other thing that it was used for, too, and this was a really important use in the 19th century, much as we might want to dismiss it now, was in order to produce clairvoyance. So there were very famous, usually women, who, when they were mesmerized, they would become able to see things that they couldn't see at other times, and people would go and ask them questions and ask them to diagnose their illnesses, ask them, in one case at least, this was imagined, what the price of cotton was in the South before the news could actually get there by newspaper from the South to the North. So the uses were really, really varied, and some of them are still consonant with what we think of as being the mainstream use of hypnosis today, that it's a stage spectacle or a cure, and some of them are less so, like clairvoyance.
I was interested too in Poyen's using it or attempted to use it, for basically his, I want to say workers, but it's really his slaves. I mean, to just mention that, you know, just tell us about that just briefly, because he was a plantation owner himself.
Poyen was French, and he was born in the French colony of Guadeloupe, and he learned about mesmerism in medical school in France, and then he returned to Guadeloupe, where he saw his fellow planters mesmerizing their enslaved laborers. And so he seems to have seen it as a kind of a labor management technique. When he brought it to the U.S., he brought it to factory cities almost as though he thought it could be used as a way to pacify or control workers in the U.S., although it never was applied on an institutional scale.
Supposedly. I'm sorry.
Right. Maybe it was never written down. We certainly have no evidence that it was applied on an institutional scale.
So let's move forward. So after, does this just keep like the cycle keeps chasing itself, or how does the field, if it were, develop from there?
Well, it does sort of keep cycling for many decades, and then. What seems to happen is less that mesmerism is finally established or debunked, which was what people were waiting for, that at one point or another one side would win out. Instead, it gets absorbed into seance spiritualism, which was a practice of going into a trance and contacting the dead and sometimes speaking as the dead or writing as the dead. So when we think of spirit mediums, that's basically what we're thinking of. So mesmerism was absorbed into that practice. It was absorbed into other 19th century and early 20th century occult practices. And in that sense, it's distantly come down to us today in the ways that those various occult practices are still alive. It just sort of lost its grip on people on both sides as a question that had to be debated as spiritualism became the more pressing concern. Could people contact the dead or couldn't they?
So, all right. So I want to just take a slight detour. It's a little bit different for this show. We generally just talk about politics, but I think that there is a relationship here, and particularly based upon sort of an online version of politics that are occurring. The relationship between secularization and modernity and the sort of the tension that was there with people wanting to become modern and secularized on some time, particularly in this era. And it mm-hmm. wasn't just happening in the United States. I mean, we see it with the emancipation of the Jews in Germany. I mean, across the world, the 19th century in many respects became obviously the there was an antecedent in the centuries before, but this notion of how do you take what was a religious impetus and secularize mm-hmm. it, and and much of it is that, and because I want to get to a quote from the coda, I guess, because it is eerily reminiscent of like what I've experienced in sort of talking about new atheists online and sort of where they bring. But just discuss that a little bit for us, because it's that tension and how sort of secularism in some ways took the husk, if you will, of religion in some ways and just refilled it with something else.
Yeah, that's a really interesting metaphor. You know, the way that I think of it is that secularism is this thing that's never fully achieved except at the moment when it's debunking religion. I guess that's one way that you might put it. And so, and I should maybe even say less religion than bad religion, because there are some kinds of religion that in a secularist framework can look perfectly fine and perfectly rational, but other kinds that don't. So mainline Protestantism in the U.S. is usually relatively compatible, maybe up until the point of the New Atheists, with a secularist consensus, whereas things like mesmerism aren't. So the way I think of it is that if you want to be secular, you need to find a credulous dupe who you can exercise your secularism on so that you can say, that guy is still pre-modern, but I'm not. I'm over here. I'm the modern one. And that's what mesmerists, in effect, offered as a package deal in their practice. They said, you know, we're going to take these subjects that we mesmerize, and we're going to work on them in exactly the same way that bad religion has always worked on people. But we're going to let that position that we're occupying of working on those people be a scientific one. We're going to have a science of duping people, a science of using credulous people. And so it really captures for me what is often present in a secularist moment, which is that religion is still there. It's just been placed in scare quotes, or it's been contained and deployed and pointed at in these particular ways.
Yeah, I mean, let me read that quote, and which I think teases that out a little bit, too. There is no special reason why you'd be freer from your idol when your idol is your freedom of choice than when it is your little wooden god. The problem with that, the empowerment argument, is it assumes that freedom is a better master. Like the idea of you're throwing the yoke off, but whatever it is you're using to throw your yoke off, it becomes your new master.
That's right. Yeah. And usually when we think of ourselves as free agents or as having self-control, you know, we're identifying ourselves with that controlling part of ourselves. But there's another part of ourselves, evidently, that's under control. And so the two are always going to be present. You don't have control without a controlled thing. And as you were reading in that quote, I don't know if we want to assume that the various different types of control, whether they are spiritual or religious or occult, or whether they are secular and rational and having to do with agency, I don't know if we want to assume that their structure is totally different or that they don't have anything to do with each other.
I mean, because my just from my experience in seeing these arguments as they play out, that rationality is sort of wielded as almost this sort of magical device that as soon as you say that your argument is rational, it immediately is, you know, the functional equivalent of like, oh, the reason why I'm king is because God said so.
Yeah. Yeah, there can be too, and this is something I talk about in the book. There can be a real pleasure in being the debunker. So some of the earliest debunkings of a mesmerism-like science had to do with debunking Perkinism, which was a way of curing people by holding metal wands to their body. And one guy tried to show that this was false by painting some wooden rods to look like metal and then holding them to people's bodies and showing people would respond in exactly the same way that they did to the metal. And he remembered applying these wands with what he called necromantic gestures while trying not to laugh. And so you can see the enjoyment of the debunker in that quote, you know, that it's really fun to be the one who knows and the one who's rational. And the easiest way to enjoy that pleasure is to find somebody else who can be the one who doesn't know and the one who isn't rational, and then just point at that person.
I mean, and to be fair, I think to a certain extent, we do this on this show, or I do this on this show about, a significant portion of the population who I think does not, that can be categorized in a bunch of different ways, that I just think that, you know, we who listen to the show are smarter than them and they're doing it wrong. And
Yeah. We all do it. I mean, you know, we all do it to some extent. And I think I do it too. And I think that we do it on the left and we do it on the right. But it's worth thinking about what the benefits are of just occupying that stylistic position. And we do see it, you know, at first, in our sort of recent political moment, it seemed like it was going to be the left move to say there's those people who don't have possession of the truth and we're the ones who do. But now it's being practiced on both sides, and it's a surprisingly portable little move to make, as mesmerists saw. As soon as somebody made it against them, they made it against somebody else, and they made it back against that person. And it's a kind of a style as well as a set of facts, and the style can sometimes be pretty disconnected from the facts.
I want to talk about Trump because you have some sort of fascinating insights in your editorial about Trump along these lines, about the idea of exposing Trump's lies in some ways, whether he's conscious of it or not, plays into his hands, or it sees, because the followers of Trump, or the supporters, I guess you could call them, like him because he's on their side. Like he is, he's on that sort of like circle of debunking. And we saw this during the campaign, right? He's like, I know these guys. Because I've dealt with the politicians. I know how corrupt they are. I know how duplicitous they are because I'm actually part of how, you know, I was part of that process. But now I'm letting you into that process. I'm not ending it. It's just like now I'm doing it on your behalf.
Yeah, that's right. And I should be clear. I think it's really vital work that journalists do when they fact check. You know, I'm as a scholar, I'm deeply committed to fact checking. Whenever I make a claim in my own writing, I do the best that I can to make sure that it's true. But I do think that it's worth explaining why
it doesn't matter.
There can be this. Yeah. Why doesn't the ground just start to shake when some of these lies are exposed? Because sometimes it seems like it really should. And I think mesmerism does provide a way to think about that, that if you just believe that you're living in a world of lies and liars, then the only person who could possibly be telling some part of the truth is the person who at least admits to having lied before. And the only person who could possibly help you or be a reasonable guide and protector for you is someone who understands how to lie. It's sort of like on a detective show that you know, your cop can't be a Pollyanna. He or she has to be someone who understands the underside of life. And I think Trump is, as you say, consciously or unconsciously, I have no idea. I don't know what his conscious strategy may or may not be, but I think he is benefiting from some kind of dynamic like that.
And I like in that piece where you wrote, instead of being one of the dupes, you could be one of the mesmerists. It's as if Trump is saying, all you had to do was sign up for a private class. And then, that's basically Trump University, right? Like that was literally.
Right. Oh, yeah. That would have been a good thing to put in. That would have been great.
I mean, that's basically what it was. Like, I have lived this life of semi-corrupt real estate practices. And for an extraordinary amount of money, I can teach you how to be just as corrupt.
Yeah. I mean, I think there might be a worldview out there where there are only scenes of deception, and that's what you're living all the time, is people are trying to take advantage of you, if not actually outright lie to you. And the only way to be on top is to be the deceiver instead of the deceived. This is something that I try to explain in my book through the work of a lot of other scholars of secularity who have actually seen that as a kind of key part of the secular, that you're always the dupe or the con man, in effect, the manipulator, the puller of the strings, and you want to make sure that you're the puller of the strings, even if that means that you have to practice a little deception of your own.
Lastly, what of the dupes, though? I mean, there's a lot of a decent amount of clinical research about that says 25% of North America is consists of right wing authoritarians. A smaller amount are left wing authoritarians, but they are the sort of the classic dupes for this type of situation. Right. The whole story is not just the guy or gal on stage, it's those people in the audience who, you know, for whom this fulfills something. What do you have to say about those people?
Well, in the book, it gets a little complicated, and here the parallel is not so helpful, I think, in understanding the present moment, or maybe it is, but in a way that I don't yet know how to tease out. In a lot of cases, when you actually look at someone who is the quote-unquote dupe of a mesmerist, that person is actually controlling things in his or her own way and has his or her own agenda and is getting his or her own needs met in various ways by the situation. So, for example, there's a clairvoyant who I talk about, Lorena Brackett, who was a middle to lower class blind woman in Providence, Rhode Island, who ended up having these incredible gifts as a clairvoyant traveler. She would travel in spirit to other cities. And some people at the time would have called her a fraud, and some people would have called her the dupe of her mesmerists. But you could also say that given the range of very limited options available to her as a blind woman, in 1830s New England, mesmerism was actually not the worst. She did these kind of improvisational performances. She had the opportunity to talk to some interesting people. She lived in some interesting places as a result. And so sometimes when we really look at the thing from the dupe's perspective, it fractures into a range of individual motivations that are not so easily described as just some idiot conned by a mastermind.
There's some element maybe of hope, as sort of maybe perverse as it is, if you have a champion, right? There's theoretically some hope that you're going to win.
That the dupe will win, you mean?
Yeah.
I'm not sure. Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
You sign up for a movement, there has to be, you know, even if it's around this guy, it is, I guess it gives you some sense of empowerment.
Yeah, that's right. And sometimes, at least with the mesmerists, I think this is different when the person we're talking about is the president of the United States. So again, I don't think the parallel holds up so well here. But with the mesmerists, you know, these were not people who had an enormous amount of social or political power. They were generally a bit more powerful than the subjects that they worked on, but not even always that. And so there was room for some give and take and some improvisation in the actual application of these practices in a lot of cases. And so there's some hope there for at least the dupes, so to speak, of mesmerists. If it doesn't, I don't see my way fully to getting hope about the present out of that situation.
Now,
but definitely for the mesmerist subjects, there was the possibility that it would turn out better for them than debunkers thought.
Are the dupes just the people who are directly impacted by the mesmerists, or are the dupes the people who are watching the person who's being a subject of a mesmerist?
You know, I think that this idea of a dupe, it only came up in debunkers' accounts, of course. You know, mesmerists didn't see it this way in quite the same way. And it could really vary. So there were some debunkings where people said that the mesmerist was the dupe and the clairvoyant was the mastermind. And then, as you say, sometimes it was that audiences had been conned by the mesmerist and the clairvoyant together, or by just one of them. So that too was a moving target. It really depended on who the particular debunker was who was applying that kind of language to the situation.
And maybe it's just a function of history. I mean, we could all end up being the dupes.
Go south. I mean, when we look back at a practice like mesmerism now, there are a lot of elements of it that just seem really unpersuasive on their face because of our current understanding of the brain or of magnetism and electricity. And a lot of those things at the time, even to people who didn't believe in mesmerism, to a lot of them, those things seemed at least superficially plausible in a way that has to do with historical change for sure.
Emily Ogden, the book is Credulity, A Cultural History of U.S. Mesmerism. Thank you so much for your time today. We'll put a link to your book at majority.fm. And once again, I appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Sam. It's been a pleasure.
Now, it is my pleasure to welcome the program. We still have Alex Perrine of Splinter News, editor of politics at Splinter News, here with us. Of course, Michael and Brendan and Matt are here. But I'd like to welcome to the program Jake Flores. He is a comedian, also a co-host of maybe my favorite named podcast.
That's a good one.
Pod Damn America.
Good afternoon.
Hi, Jake. Welcome to the program. And I should say that I first heard about your story from Splinter News, which mm-hmm. I had forgotten, of course. But okay, before we get into you telling us about yourself, well, actually, why don't you tell us about yourself? You're a comedian. You host Pod Damn America. What happens on Pod Damn America?
I started Pod Damn America about a year ago after Charlottesville kind of went down, and I found myself, doing what I do as a comedian, I've been doing stand-up for, you know, a little over a decade now, and it's kind of been a thing for a long time. But also, you know, I'm heavily involved in a sort of burgeoning leftist movement that's happening in America right now, and I'm, you know, invested in it. And so I found myself sort of writing a lot and sort of, you know, using platforms like Facebook and Twitter to kind of put information out that I thought was important. But then I sort of realized, well, if you're not publishing stuff, I mean, algorithm just, you know, fades whatever you're writing away. So I started as a project to just sort of, you know, be a part of sort of the new left, because in my opinion, like, it's not a new idea. I mean, I kind of aped like what Chapo Trap House is doing and those types of people that are, you know, huge and successful. I just kind of thought that, you know, if we're going to have an actual left movement in this country, there should be like as many leftist comedy outlets as there are straight up liberal comedy outlets, you know. It shouldn't be like a singular idea. So I kind of thought of it as just, you know, doing my part and throwing in my little area of expertise into the ring, you know. I started off by doing some episodes about Antifa because I just noticed that suddenly this thing that I kind of know about was in the news and nobody else knew about it. So, you know, we started from there, and we figured out a way to make it funny and make it kind of interesting and, you know, just doing what I can, I suppose.
Sounds good. And so you tweeted something out. Now, I know that there's a, sort of a danger of people who are comedians tweeting things can sometimes get you in trouble.
Yeah, so I hear, Sam.
I've had my own experience with that. But with that said, I think what went down with you is a lot scarier than what went down with me, frankly. Let me read this tweet of yours from May 5th, 2018. And you write, okay, here's how Cinco de Mayo works in 2018. White people are allowed to culturally appropriate on the condition that you help destroy ICE. You kill one ICE agent and you get to wear a sombrero. Two kills and you get to wear a poncho.
So, we didn't appreciate that. If you're angry at the policy, blame Congress.
Now, so, so now, Jake, was this some type of joke?
Oh, absolutely not.
Do I hear knocking on your door again?
Yeah, we listened to the Majority Report. I'm a Jewish guy. And,
can we put the scroll? Can we put the scroll underneath here? Everything is satirical that we're talking about. Please, can we just drop that scroll right underneath? All right. So you tweet this out on Cinco de Mayo. Did you have other Cinco de Mayo tweets or other tweets talking about ICE?
Probably. I was kind of on an ICE kick that day, you know. That was probably the big one. I was doing a lot of a bit I came up with was drinking these big cans of Bud Ice and yelling "Abolish ICE" while I drink them. That was pretty fun. You know, just dumb stuff like that.
That sounds like something that like they would maybe even contemplate using as an online campaign. I feel like that's like that's like the teens version of Waza. Dude, where's my beer? I abolished all the ice.
Yeah, that's all right.
You can have all this stuff too, incidentally. I'm not. So, all right. So, you tweet it out, and how does it do? Does it get? Do you get a lot of retweets on this? Do you get like? What was your ratio?
So it was kind of interesting because, you know, I'm an extremely online millennial, you know, so I just tweet every other thought that comes into my brain, and I use the internet as sort of a scratch pad. Like, I was using this as a way to remember it so I could work it out as a bit later on, which now, with the whole thing that happened, I got a great fucking 12 minutes out of it. Sorry, can I curse? Sorry.
Yeah, you can.
Okay, cool. What's interesting, though, is that it was pretty well received. Like, I didn't have anyone directly respond to me. and say anything negative. Like, it, I got retweets, I got shares on Facebook. Everyone kind of laughed. A couple of people went, whoa, you know, like, you're just playing with fire there. But nobody really came at me, and the post didn't get taken down, which leads me to believe that it probably didn't get reported by another user, because when you get reported by another user, the platform flags the post, because now it's a liability, right?
But you seem to have had some experience with this.
It was clearly totally different from the other times when I personally pissed somebody off directly, because you know.
I mean, yes, though. Like, this is part of my job, you know?
Hell yeah.
And so, you know, nothing happened until 9 a.m. the next day when the feds kicked on my door. And
no, wait a second. Yeah. Wait. You gotta ease into this. So you're sitting there.
The Baileys.
So, all right, you're now, I assume if you're a comedian, it's 9 a.m., you're asleep, right?
Oh, my, yes.
Okay. So you're asleep, and I assume also you don't have a kid or anything like that. So you're totally asleep. And what? And how does like, do you get a doorbell knock? Is a buzzer? Somebody slide a note under your door? What happens?
Okay, so this is kind of pertinent to the story. I don't live in a regular apartment. I live in a loft, which is like a punk house situation. It's a factory in a part of Brooklyn that is not really residential, and nothing's labeled. It's really hard to get into the building. When I order food on Seamless, you know, they don't know where it is. Like, I have to come downstairs, because even if they get inside, which they can't, there's no numbers on the doors or anything. There's just graffiti everywhere and stuff. And so it's very odd that they found me within a day. And
all right, well, no, wait, Jake. Now, is this door. Like, are you, is it like a squatter situation? I mean, or do you not want to, we'll skip that.
it's not. It's called Loft Law. It's just, you're allowed to live in an art studio, basically, in New York. Okay. Until they destroy this law in a year or two.
Oh, right, exactly.
But it's a semi.
Do you get your mail there?
Yeah, I get mail. I kind of usually get stuff sent to wherever I'm working, though, because I'm very reliable, because there's all sorts of crazy, you know, people running in and out all the time, and mails technically works, but, you know, it's not that reliable.
I'm just curious as to how did they track you down?
I don't know. And I mean, this does raise a lot of questions about, like, the surveillance state and, like, cell phones and things like that, because, like, not only do they know, you know, where I lived, they knew I would be there, which I'm not always there. You know, I mean, like, traveling around, I often don't sleep home, you know.
Nice.
My guess would be my phone, but anyone say, I suppose. And they also could have just talked to, I don't know, like the people that own the building or something. I mean, there is record of me being there. It's not a complete plot or anything, but it's odd that they were able to pull it off that quickly.
So they're knocking on, they've got into the building somehow, and they're knocking on your apartment door, loft door, and do they just knock? I mean, what do you, like, what, do people knock on your door at 9 a.m. often? Is that the first time that's ever happened?
People don't knock on my door is the thing. Like, this is not an apartment where people are walking around, you know, asking each other for cups of sugar and stuff like that. I woke up, and you know, there's this loud banging on the door, and so I would not have answered it, honestly, if I didn't think it was a repair guy. I just waiting for this guy to show up and fix this leak I had in my ceiling. I mean, there's pipes leaking all over the place, rats everywhere. There's a window fell out of the week before this. So I kind of just assumed in my groggy, hungover state that, oh, it's the repair guy, you know? And I opened the door, lo and behold, 4 DHS agents. They say Department of Homeland Security. I think one of them holds up a badge. And from there, I'm a little groggy on, like, what happened. Because,
well, wait a second. What are they wearing? Tell me what they're wearing. I'm curious. Were they wearing those, like, parkas that have, like, DHS on the back? Or what? Did they have any? No. What were they wearing? They're just wearing suits?
Not suits. Just, like, kind of dorky button-downs and stuff like that. you know, they look like nerds.
Did you tell them,
like,
that?
You know, Carrie Matheson, Mandy Patinkin on Homeland. You know, just professional garb.
I didn't know. I was so, like, such pussies.
So, wait a second. So, casual Friday stuff.
Yeah, of course.
Okay.
It was the weekend, you know, for them, too.
Wait, this is on a Sunday?
Jesus Christ.
What day was it? Was it,
yeah.
Was it a Sunday?
It was, yeah, it was a Sunday morning. Cinco de Mayo was Saturday. Sunday morning was the next day.
Well, at least
all the scary ICE agents had the weekend off.
That's right. Yeah, I guess. Tax dollars at work. At least yeah. they're on tour.
So you should have known it's not the repair guy because he never right. comes on time on a weekend.
That's how they break it. That's how they break out the assignment. Like, all right, the actual guys, you've got some families to destroy upstate.
Right.
The ones you don't look intimidating at all. You should go terrorize this comedian kid off of Twitter.
Yeah, basically.
So, okay, so the four guys come in, and they just look dorky. They're dressed like the dad on some type of sitcom or, like, you know, right?
Is no, he said Carrie and Mandy Patinkin. Yeah. Okay, that worked okay. well.
So so what happens? They do you invite them in? What do you sit down at your table? Do you have a table in your apartment?
Yeah. Okay, so here's how this goes down, right? They sort of... You know, they throw me off. I open the door. So they're Homeland Security. And I can't remember whether like, they just came in or I went like, all right, whatever. Let's just do this. And a lot of people will come at you with these sort of like libertarian, like, you know, you should have said, am I being detained? And all this stuff. Do you have any experience with actual police? You know, they don't honor that stuff in the moment. Like, you kind of just have to do what they're
right.
going to do and
right.
then figure that stuff out in court later, you know?
Did you know why they were there?
I'm sorry?
Did you know why they were there? Like, did you go like, oh, it's that tweet that I had about ICE?
I figured it out pretty quick because they mentioned something about ICE. They, like, asked me about ICE. And then also another part of this that kind of, I think they kind of maybe were trying to intimidate me on some level, like, wake you up, right? The thing is, I was out till 6 in the morning, so I was still drunk. Like, I was like, whatever, let's do this. But also, this happened to a pal of mine, like, 2 years ago. Nick Mullen got the FBI called on him. And Nick Mullen, if you don't know, is your friend, your friend Mike Cernovich thinks Nick Mullen is the head of the DSA. President.
Is that true? Is that true?
Yeah, he tweeted out the DSA
Mike
had a conference. Yeah. The DSA had a conference.
Who's laughing now, Nick?
I do like guys who are like who have never dealt with anything in their lives, and they would say like, what you do when federal agents show up at your place at 9 o'clock in the morning is you say, according to Article 265 of the Bill of Rights, and then they can't enter your domicile, dude. What the hell is the matter with you?
I will not be quartering soldiers here.
I know.
I don't recognize the federal government. Yeah. I am a citizen of the state of New York.
Yeah,
so wait a
second. This art shed,
anyone,
sir.
Yeah.
So they start talking about ICE, but it's not until they mention ICE that you think this is about the tweet. So you don't know immediately. You're just like, must have been something I did. What like? Are there other things that you felt like you did that might have like had DHS at your door?
Honestly, I figured it out pretty quick. I mean, I don't really know what else I could have done. I'm kind of a scumbag, but I'm not really, like, up to anything. So I don't really think there's anything else that would have crossed my mind. Like, oh, my God, what did I, you know, did I get away with this thing in my past? I mean, on some level, I think their job is to intimidate you a little bit. They're an arm of the authoritarian apparatus, you know? But I found myself in a unique situation because when the government comes and knocks on your door, you know, if you have kids or something, it's terrifying because you don't know what's going to happen.
Right.
They may tear you away from your kids, right? But I'm a shitty comedian. Like, I don't have anything. So I just, you know, I was like, oh, I got nothing to lose. I'm so hungover. I don't care if I die right now. You know?
Did you say this to them?
Everything. I don't know.
Are you quoting yourself?
You can't blackmail me. I've been actively trying to get famous for 10 years, you know?
Right.
It doesn't matter. So I just...
It's like, as I see it, you're either going to kill me or this is a major uptick in my
right,
Twitter
exactly.
following.
Right.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, either I'm dead or this is the best thing that's ever happened.
There's two ways to play this. Capital One murder,
like,
which we're not quite
I'm,
at yet for Twitter
I'm,
jokes, or you just Dave
I'm
me a great favor, guys.
So, all right. So they start talking to you, and what do they say?
Well, you know, they start talking to me about the ice thing, and you know, I first thing I do is we're standing around, and I go, one of them's like, "Should we sit down?" And I go, "Yeah, sure, we'll sit down at my table." I have this table in my like loft space, living room, where I record my podcast, right? And the table's got all these microphones set up at it. Sit down. He looks, the main guy looks at the microphone and he goes, "Are these things recording?" And I go, "No." And he believes me. And I, they weren't recording, but like, what kind of government agent are you?
Don't even check. Well, first of all, I think we've all learned a great lesson today. If you have a table full of microphones and there's a knock at your door, turn on the recording device.
You know what would be funny? You know what I love? Then answer you know door. Like those old infomercials with the clap? You just, you're like, 1 second. Now they're off.
So, okay. So he says, okay, good.
He starts asking me.
So they sit down at that point?
I'm sorry?
Do they sit down after you've assured them that the microphones are off?
Yeah, so we sit down, me and the main guy, right? So there's this main guy, and then there's these three other guys. And the three other guys don't have cameras. And what they're doing is they're going around my apartment taking photos and, I guess, building a case file on me, which is, that's kind of interesting. There's just a file on me now.
You've got to be shitting
me. File on lots of people. It's interesting to know, you know? I know people who are in like J20 and stuff that know they have a file and et cetera, but like, what is going on in this file with me? Because, you know, for one thing, they're taking pictures of all the art on the walls, and it's not my stuff. I have this roommate who was like super goth and weird and just like, you know, made this place look like a corn video, and then she moved out and all that stuff is still there. I'm talking to this guy and I'm like, don't read into the art on the walls. It's not part of my whole thing, you know. I'm not this like weird the crow terrorist guy, you know. But he asks me eventually about, you know, about ICE and about the tweet or whatever. And I tell him, like, I know you know who I am. You looked me up. Clearly you know I'm a comedian. You know I'm joking. So what we're talking about here is, you know, how do we deal with jokes? Because if I had written a novel, you know, some sort of dystopian future thing, it wouldn't be a question. And if I had written a TV show about this, it might have been successful. This sort of stuff is popular right now, you know. Because it's a joke, we have this whole thing where we take them literally and we don't deal with the subtext, context that everyone who's in the world actually understands when you're clearly joking about something, you know?
Right. Not to mention the fact that you don't have really the official capacity to allow for the cultural appropriation, yes. Nor the mechanism to measure it, right? Like you haven't.
Right.
You're not.
No, he was. He was actually La Raza co-signed.
So yeah.
It's a deal I have with La Raza, man.
Where are the spreadsheets where you're keeping track of of who's been shot and who gets to culturally appropriate the poncho?
Yeah,
that's what they were taking the pictures for. Silly, they were looking for the abacus where you do all the numbers on it.
Yeah.
Yeah. The algorithm, you know? So I start talking to him about that, and he goes, like, yeah, you know, it's a good point. I'm like, well, that's a good point. What are you doing in my apartment? Like, you could have sent me an email or something, you know? He starts to go on to the concept of like, insightfulness, you know? And, well, you know, we know you're joking, but what if the wrong person heard this and took it seriously? Which, by the way, hilarious. Like, I know that's a messed up idea, but if someone
to wear a poncho, that actually, like, they were like,
right.
This guy on Twitter says I can wear a poncho if.
Yeah. I mean, if that's the standard.
Seems like a high price to pay, but I'm willing
honestly,
to do it.
If that's the standard, when Ben Shapiro right now would be in some serious hot water because he apparently, you know, was the number one Twitter read by the guy who killed folks up in Canada at the mosque.
Right.
And, you know, Ben Shapiro is not funny. He's not even trying to make jokes when he says, when he's done all his videos saying, like, this is just a matter of time. Half of all Muslims are radicalized. They're going to kill your family.
Right.
And this guy...
Ignoring the corn work.
He doesn't
corn
even have
artem.
The satire crawl.
He doesn't have the satire crawl. He doesn't have any of that.
Ignore the gothic art on the wall, guys.
So I am... we'll get to how much these free speech guys came to your rescue in a minute. But... So you're saying this with the guy, and the guy says, yeah, I mean, it's a good point, but it's possibly insightful. You may convince somebody out there who is humor-challenged to actually do this because they think that they're going to get to wear a sombrero on Cinco de Mayo, and then what?
So when he brings up the insightfulness thing, I ask, like, well, then why aren't you kicking in Alex Jones's door and, like, right. Roseanne Barr? Because I work... at a pizza restaurant in New York, and we get daily Pizzagate death threats, like a daily. Do you understand it? That's how much power she actually has. And she's not joking. Like, people actually take that seriously, you know? And so, like, they kind of just buck after a while, and they're like, well, fair point. And I'm like, well, you know, well, then why are we having this whole conversation? But it does, you know, beg a lot of questions about free speech, how it's like, is it really free if it's only selectively enforced, you know? And I think I'm being visited by these people because I made fun of the government, and these free speech guys that imagine that they're all going to get visited by the government never will, because they believe all the same stuff as the government, you know? It's really funny how jealous a lot of these free speech dork comedians probably are over this. This is every comedian's fantasy, you know? You want to be Lenny Bruce or whatever. But anyway, we move on, and we start talking about ICE, and ICE, you know, I ask him a question after a while, because at the end of this, as we start getting near the end of this whole conversation, he asks me if I have any questions for him, like we're in a job interview or something, you know, and I'm like, okay, well, in closing, you know, what are you here to defend? Like, what is the thing that ICE does that you sort of believe in? Because he had started to go into this this logic after a while, this argument of like, well, you know, how many interactions do you think ICE has on a daily basis that don't get taped and put on the internet, yada yada yada. And I've talked to a million cops about this. It's the same argument they all use, right? Which is that there's some sort of inherent job that the police are doing that is good and for the community and everything, and these videos that we see are designed to make you outraged, and they're, you know, they're only what happens 1% of the time. And I don't believe that argument when it comes to cops, but that's at least a valid argument, because at some level the police, you know, it's set to protect and serve and out of their cars, you know. But with ICE, their stated mission is what people are against, you know.
Right.
Shouldn't exist. They're only 10 years old. Like, this is not an age-old institution or anything. So ask him that. And he goes, oh, ICE fights human trafficking. And I'm I'm a little boned up on this issue called SESTA-FOSTA. If you're not familiar, SESTA-FOSTA is a bill that passed recently that was sold as fighting human trafficking. In reality, it's extremely anti-woman, extremely pro-patriarchy, extremely anti-sex worker, right?
Well, it's also a net negative in terms of fighting trafficking, because it drives it further underground, mm-hmm. and basically prevents a mechanism that was out there to sort of track where traffickers were.
Exactly, and that's because it's not actually about sex trafficking; it's about, like, the organizations that pushed it to begin with are like right-wing Christian organizations that also don't want Cosmo to be sold like on shelves at supermarkets, right? So this isn't about that. This is about old gender patriarchy stuff. So they use this scapegoat of human trafficking to sell bills like SESTA-FOSTA. If you look at everyone who got arrested after SESTA-FOSTA, everyone who got arrested was a sex worker who got arrested for sex work, not for trafficking, right? So it's pretty obvious how they use these, like, switcheroos, right? Immediately when he told me that, I was like, I know exactly what you're doing. I know exactly the argument. That's the same bullshit they used to pass SESTA-FOSTA, right? And he comes to me and he goes, what's SESTA-FOSTA?
You're ace.
I was like, all right, everyone sit down, you know, and I started talking about SESTA-FOSTA to the Department of Homeland Security, the human trafficking police, you know, which is supposedly this is their job. And after a while, they just kind of like looked at each other, wrapped up, and, you know, told me, oh, okay, well, you know, we'll be watching you and you may expect another visit and good luck on your tour. Ha, 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 you know, top humor or whatever. and then I went on with my day and I told the story to Catherine Kruger over at Splinter. You know, I did Chapo about it and stuff like that.
That's unbelievable. It's amazing too. Those guys have since quit, and they are now actively
Patreon members.
They're Patreon members of Pod Damn America. So, all right, let me ask you this: Have you talked to a lawyer?
Yeah, I've talked to a couple people, some people with the ACLU, et cetera. Probably not as much as I should have. I've got some numbers kind of in my back pocket over, you know, whether this could go extremely south. It's just that I had to leave for a tour immediately after this happened. Like, I already had a tour booked, so I had to go jump in a van and drive across the country. I didn't really have a lot of options for making a huge long-term plan while I was about to be working all day, every day. I don't really know exactly what I even should be preparing for because I'm pretty sure I'm not going to get revisited by these guys. You know, I mean, it still is always there in my mind.
I'd just be curious to hear what a lawyer says about this. I mean, I guess when they came to your door, you did invite them in. But
vampire law applies.
But I think the real question is whether or not you have a First Amendment case, because this is actually, and I'm sure. You know, you've heard, I'm sure Dave Rubin has reached out to you, and I'm sure you're already booked on the Dave Rubin show, and I'm sure all of these free speech warriors.
He has a right to make jokes, and ICE has a right to respond. Because so circle the wagons
here's
on
the,
ourselves.
Here's the fundamental difference between your situation and every other situation that Dave Rubin talks about. It is a free speech question when the government is involved, period, end of story. If a corporation doesn't want you to speak and say something when they hire you, they can fire you right away unless there's any specific legislation against that. But it's only free speech, obviously, when the government is chilling your speech. And I don't know how this could be interpreted in any other way with government agents, literally agents of the government, coming to your apartment after a tweet and saying, you should really think twice about those type of tweets. If they've got a case that you're inciting, they should take you to jail. They should have you go in front of a court and say, this guy's inciting, you know, the death of federal agents. And I think any judge would laugh it out of a courtroom. But I think there's a First Amendment case here because, I mean,
it's chilling. It's chilling speech.
It's literally the definition.
I guess Ruben would be interested if your pizza place fired you.
That's right.
Then it would be.
Then it would be like just
talk about
pizza place. But yeah, so I mean, I think you should. I mean, I would follow it up with the ACLU, and maybe somebody hears this and you know reaches out to you because it really does seem like a perfect example of the chilling of free speech. I just wonder how many other people this has happened to. Have you heard from anybody else that has been through this experience?
Well, yeah. I mean, there's obviously a much more chilling story about an activist that was jailed for an insane amount of time. There's a story in The Guardian about this guy, and I can't remember his name off the top of my head, but there was a guy who was jailed and taken away from his family over posts that were, you know, he's not a comedian, but they were
Black Lives Matter activists.
Oh,
they just said things with a colorful use of language, you know. So there's real, you know, this is really happening. Also, when I was talking to the DHS agent, I asked him, you know, like why he was here, and he said, well, you know, we have had similar cases in the past, that have been more insidious. And I asked him if someone was doing my material out there, because that's not okay with me, you know. sorry, I had to slip in a Lenny Bruce joke. Okay, so, but the thing about this is that you're right. I mean, this is actually a free speech issue in that government is involved. When people talk about, you know, the war on Roseanne or whatever as being a free speech issue, that's not free speech. No. Because the government isn't involved. You're exactly right. That's just someone not wanting to, you know, pay you anymore, which they have a total right to do. I am kind of on the fence about whether I want to take this any further, because my experience with the police in, you know, the past is, if I can make this not a thing, that's better for my general safety. Right. But on the other hand, I mean, if this is a, you know, if this is something that could have some sort of positive effect, well, then, yeah, sure, I'll go and make a, you know, a case out of it and make a story out of it, because, you know, it's absolutely true. I just don't know, you know, if I'm super into the idea of risking getting jailed over it.
I can understand that. You don't want the late career Jake Flores to be up doing a 4-hour diatribe reading from court records, a la Lenny Bruce's last.
Yeah, I was just reading the transcript film. Of his own
yeah,
trial.
Exactly.
Can I just want to note the story of this Black Lives Matter activist. He was literally imprisoned over a Facebook post. He lost his house, his separated from his children. And ironically, you talked earlier about like who's really inciting things. The information where apparently they said they learned about the protests and what he was doing came from InfoWars content that they watched.
That's right. I remember that detail. Yeah.
Yeah. So think about that circle.
That's just like Project Veritas exactly. Videos being used in the prosecution.
J20. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's
yeah.
the same dynamic.
Right. It's also another reason why I may not be too keen on taking this case into the heart of the system, because I don't have a lot of faith in the system at this point if, you know, they're getting their information from InfoWars and stuff like that. A dangerous thing to do, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I think like, you know, I just don't know. I totally respect that and appreciate that and understand that. But for folks at home, even that sentiment is indicative of chilling free speech. Yep. I mean, this is not it's a crazy story, and Jake, I really appreciate your sharing it with us. It's going to get a lot more exposure when Ruben has you on his show. I will say that.
Also, can I say one last thing? Actually,
please.
On that note, I do believe that on some level, the job of this branch of the government was to come to me and to intimidate me, and they always do this to comedians, I think, because they think that like the joke is going to be me coming back and going, whoa, guys, don't mess with the big bad government. They know exactly what they're doing. And I definitely don't want that to be the message of this, even if I do what I'm going to do one way or the other at the end of the story. I mean, the message of this should be that this is a monstrous thing. You know,
right.
I don't want the whole reason I did what I did was I thought to myself, well, I'm in a unique position to be able to stand up to this where other people probably couldn't. So, you know, to that degree, I mean, you're right. Maybe the right thing to do would be to go forward with this. I just don't know where it's going to go. But, yeah, I definitely don't want to end on a down note here. I mean, you know, fuck all these people.
Right. Jake, it's a great story. I really appreciate it. It's your Twitter handle is @FeralJokes, which also could have been a tip off to the ICE agents.
You mean like people should go rabid? Like what's going on?
And your website is feraljokes.com. People can go check out your schedule as you go around. Thanks so much for the time today, Jake. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So Dave Rubin proves to Joe Rogan that all of his economic theories and his small, lean government philosophies are just literally mumbo jumbo. Not even jingoistic, because he hasn't even taken the time to learn the jingos. Now he's going to move into the cultural realm where he's far more comfortable. He's a comedian. He's a social critic, and. And you know he's a social critic because he's wearing a black T-shirt. Now, yeah, and so here he is going to explain to Joe Rogan the dynamic of racism in this country. And here's the thing is he, when you talk about what I guess, you know, identity politics is about, and yes, different people use different definitions. The one thing that I've never heard anybody say is that identity politics on the left or the right is about knowing what the other person is thinking, right? Like it's not like I can divine what someone else is thinking.
You never read Kwame Ture's book, Knowing What Someone Else Is Thinking, The Roots of Radical Identity Politics in a Racist America?
It's not about knowing. It's about... There are structural issues that exist in society that, based upon certain elements of your identity, will increase the likelihood that your experience will differ from others in this way. Right? As you pass through society, your lived experience, broadly speaking, not every single same thing happens to every single person. But broadly speaking, you will experience things that are different and not necessarily even totally unique, but more common amongst a group that you share certain characteristics with. He doesn't even understand that part of what he's bullshitting about, which is, like I say, I mean, the greatest argument as to why people without government regulation will do a subpar job at even their job. But here he is explaining to Joe Rogan about racism.
A little bit, like a little lie. I think nobody would even pick up on it.
Do you think that's what they're doing? I think they're just misrepresenting. I don't think they're saying the opposite of the truth. They're finding these little categories like homophobia, transphobia, sexism.
Well, he's not a homophobe.
Oh,
he's
pause it. Pause it for 1 second. He's talking. Dave Rubin's talking about his tour with Jordan Peterson, and he's now going to make the argument, go backwards just a little bit, that Jordan Peterson can't be in any way homophobic because he works in close proximity on this tour with a gay guy being Dave Rubin. I don't know if I should say this before or after Dave Rubin says this, but he is making the argument that could apply to, like, you could hear from someone maybe, I don't know, a couple hundred years ago, like, I have Negroes in my home. I have Negroes in my home taking care of my children. You tell me I have a problem. I give them free boarding, free food, in return for a little bit of work.
I thought the FBI was homophobic until I heard some rumors about J. Edgar Hoover.
That's right. There you go. But here's Dave Rubin making that argument. Not that his ideas are promoting homophobia. Not that his the perspective he has on transgender folk are transgender phobic, but that, like, his close proximity to me is proof.
Look, if you give me an opportunity to hang out with some bubblehead gay guy and makes stupid money hand over fist, I'll do it. I'm a pragmatist.
They're finding these little categories like homophobia, transphobia,
sexism.
Well,
he's not a homophobe. He's on tour with a gay guy. He's not right. A transphobe. There are trans people that show up there, and I discussed it with him every freaking night. I ask, you know, so I basically do like 15 minutes of stand-up up top. He does an hour and a half, and then we do a Q&A together. And we bring out all of these things, and every night to clear it up, and sometimes I'll have people bust out their phones, and I'll be like, why don't you guys record this tonight, and let's get it out on Twitter, where he takes down down the alt-right because he hates the identity politics of the right as much as the identity politics of the left. I mean, I think the reason we all focus on the thing of the left is because it has encompassed culture and media and politics and what you're allowed to say and universities and all of that. So it makes more sense to focus on that. The little sliver of it that's on the right. Yeah,
pause it. I just want to track where he is in this conversation. The little sliver of identity politics on the right
is governing the country.
Now, it is. Well, it's not just governing in the country now. It has been the governing principle of this country since its founding.
Since before it was a country.
Right. I mean, I assume he's talking about white people, right? I mean, because it's like, I think he's talking about white people here. And to say that identity politics for white people has not been the governing principle of this country is just absurd. We have example after example after example after example, I mean, ad nauseum, on both societal and governmental and institutional.
I think there's a lot of
white identity politics.
A lot of people could actually make the other argument.
All right, well, but I just wanted to just put a marker to get a sense of where we are, because he's talked a bunch of mumbo jumbo. But the real problem is all the identity politics on the left, which is apparently just, you can see it because what it involves is critiques of Dave Rubin on his Twitter feed. But go.
Well, and all of that. So it makes more sense to focus on that. The little sliver of it that's on the right. Yeah, it's shitty. It's horrible. You should not look at your skin color as some great thing that makes you better.
But is that a right thing? Is racism always a right thing?
Like, no, not at all.
Are racists right?
No, I think the left is far more racist than the right at
really?
This moment. Yeah.
Why do you think that?
Because identity politics is based in racism. You happen to be white. I know nothing about you by the color of your skin. I know about Joe Rogan because I watch the show.
I could tell you a couple of things about that guy who happens to be white. I can tell you that he doesn't randomly get stopped in his car with any type of regularity as he drives through L.A. I know that. I mean, I've never asked Joe Rogan that question. I haven't talked to Joe Rogan, but I know that. And I know there's a huge amount of black people who in a similar economic class to Joe Rogan, who in fact get stopped. In fact, they're being part of that class and driving a certain car is the reason why they get stopped. I know that Joe Rogan has never, never once in his life stopped to think like, hey, did I not get that job, or did that guy react to me that way because I'm white? Joe Rogan never had to say like, hey, is my race in some way inhibiting my opportunity?
When he says small slice of the right, I think he's only acknowledging the Richard Spencers of the world who actively want to make laws to oppress people of color. And he's not thinking about the fact that the status quo is white supremacy. And if you don't do anything, if you're like a hands-off libertarian, that is supporting white supremacy, because that is the status quo right now.
I mean, it's always been, and there have been, we have had systemic and statutory repression of black people for the vast majority of our history.
Dave Rubin should do a deep dive into Reconstruction.
Yeah, yes, people get into or into
or pick a decade.
The New Deal, or let's say into miscegenation.
I mean,
laws,
people get
or...
into like the nitty gritty of like race and stuff, but I guess I'm just focusing it more on like the ideas level.
The idea
that was.
All right, wait, continue. Is there anything more than this?
White. I know nothing about you by the color of your skin. I know about Joe Rogan because I watch the show. I listen to the show. We've done this several times. And hours that we're going to sit here now, we can dive as deep into any issue. And that's the only way that I can sensibly judge you.
But
the idea that you will look at people, that you would look at a black person would be sitting there, or a Muslim person would be sitting there, or a trans person sitting there, and you'd go, I have even the inkling of what you think because of that immutable characteristic, that is actual racism.
Pause it. First off.
He thinks he nailed it, right? He thinks he's like really saying something.
First off, there's nobody on the left, and I don't know, maybe on the right, but I don't. There's nobody on the left who's going like, I know what you think.
I can name one on the right, Jordan Peterson. When he says he talks about pronouns, he's saying it's like a cultural Marxist plot.
And that what they're they're attempting. That's why they're doing it. Right. He's the one who's imparting upon
others. It's a conspiracy theory based on his ESP.
Right.
Can we get the video?
But on the left, when I think I see a white person, a transgender person, a Muslim person, and a black person, I think is what Dave said up there. I do know. I don't know the specifics of these individuals, but I do know the likelihood, broadly speaking, of what their experience is in our world today. I mean, broadly speaking, we were to have 10 black people, 10 Muslims, 10 trans people, and 10 white people. And what else did he say? I can't remember. I could broadly tell you what a significant portion of each one of those has gone through. I could list five things that they probably experience in the world. Like the trans person probably has dealt with a job discrimination, has dealt with housing discrimination. The Muslim has probably gone around and dealing with cultural discrimination and probably concern for his children or her children. A trans person is probably worried about their physical well-being, depending on where they live. Of course, if they all live where Dave Rubin lives, they'd be in much better shape he lives in the bastion of liberalism that he hates. I would like to do this project. In fact, I would pay for it. Here's my challenge to Dave Rubin. I want you to move to rural Georgia. Or rural Alabama. Now,
do the show from there.
Do the show from there. Take your message to the people who will really appreciate it. You can show them.
Judge you by your essentials.
We have no way to predict how they're going to react, right? We know they're not going to judge.
Yeah, well, they're not
when
gonna
you
judge
and your husband
gay,
walk through town. Right. Holding hands, as you should be able to do, and of course you would. There's no way to predict how the people there. I would never deign to generalize or in any way use my ESP to predict how they're going to react. And this would be a great way for us to all learn. This would be a great way for you to face, like to completely pawn those of us who are skeptical about your politics. Because you have made it really clear that one of the staples of your of why it is wrong for your ideological perspective to be considered anything other than a classical liberal, you would for whatever reason rely on identity politics, your personal relationship with your spouse to prove that you are not a a right wing purveyor of right wing thought. I would say, let's put that to the test. You're right. There's no way for us to possibly know how these folks in rural Alabama or rural Georgia are going to react to the new couple that has moved to town and hold hands and are publicly affectionate like any other couple might be. Heterosexual couple.
May I just say, I mentioned this yesterday, but I just want to say again, in the conversation on the Baker case, which we didn't even get to, one of the lines, and I am paraphrasing, but not terribly, not by much, he said, Dave Rubin said something to the effect of it, I know people like to get into the legal details on these things.
Yeah. Oh, he's talking about the court case?
Yes, yeah. Usually when you're talking about a Supreme Court case, you get into the
legal details.
To be fair, that's what Lawfare's motto is.
He's really earning that Coke money right now.
It's unbelievable. It really is just unbelievable.
If we have someone who could do video mashups, I would love to mash up that Dave Rubin video with the Stephen Colbert clip where he's like, I don't see race. I'm told that I'm white, and I guess I got to take people's word for it.
Right.
The office.
Also, have you challenged Rubin to a debate, Sam?
Yeah. I will reiterate that I will debate Dave Rubin in any context, on any show, in any medium, and or any place at any time.
Boom.
I
feel bad.
With any rules?
I feel bad for Dave, so let me help him out here. Dave, you're an idiot. Oh, sorry.
Michael, all right.
All right, fine.
We're going to have to convene human resources.
Sean just tweeted, Antifada wonders why Rubin Report, who's willing to go so hard debating the demerits of the postal system with Joe Rogan, is unwilling to engage in a debate with Sam Cedar.
Well,
let's see who gets owned in a tete-a-tete between Coke money and Casper mattress money.
There you go. Bingo.
Do you guys remember why Rubin got mad at us, the video that we did?
Well, that was where my joke was coming from. Yeah.
Those two groups, I still think, is mostly Jesus's fault. That's Jesus right there. Even though Jesus probably would have been
loved
them
both, right?
Muslims, and
well, that's
he was around a lot of Muslims. It was the Middle East.
I'm sorry, I know
it's the Middle East.
Oh, I forgot about that.
That was amazing.
Like I say, do 5 minutes worth of reading. You know. God,
he could literally be illiterate. Like this could be like,
yeah, maybe he literally
doing Catalano.
He has enough time to defend the Muslim ban, but not enough time to understand that Jesus wouldn't have known them. Literally, just chronologically. I love
when I look at a guy like that. I'm just like, I'm jealous of the fact that he doesn't have kids. You know, he works with his spouse. Like he's got, you know, he's got plenty of time to dedicate to his business and to just like to set aside. Take 5 minutes off of the time in the gym and just like, I'm going to read 5 minutes worth of stuff about what I'm going to talk
and
about.
Try today. Audible, Dave.
Yeah.
You guys are being real cultural elites right now about people who can read or not read. And also possibly ableist, okay?